We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for another episode. Let me introduce today's guest straight away before I explain what today's episode's about, actually. So I'm going to say hi once again to Raquel Stetcher. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back.
It's a pleasure, as always. So Raquel and I, on this episode, we're going to talk principally about a book. The book is called Letters from Hollywood, Inside the Private World of Classic American Movie Making. The book is compiled and edited by Rocky Lang and Barbara Hall. So we'll talk all about that in a little bit, but we're also going to talk a bit about Raquel's summer reading challenge, which she's running this year as ever, and what we've been reading and stuff like that. So yeah, Raquel, it seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's been a good level of engagement so far this year for the reading challenge. So how's it going?
It's been going great. We have 39 registered participants, which is wonderful. I think that's a record. And so far, I counted this morning, we have over 50 reviews that have been posted. And I'm working on my second roundup. I try for this challenge, I make sure I read every single participant's review and comment on them, but I also do roundups on my website just to share so people can see what other participants are reading. So I'm going to be working on my second roundup soon, but I'm just really impressed. Some people have already finished the challenge. I know Vanessa from Super Veebs. She's always really great about this challenge. She's already read and reviewed her sixth books, and I think she's going to review maybe a couple extra ones. So super impressed. Yeah. I, on the other hand, just finished my third book, which is the one we're talking about today. So I still have time. Everyone has till the 15th. And you've also been reviewing books too, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it's been great to see how people do different things. They review on Instagram, or in this case, we're doing a podcast episode, and then other people review on Goodreads. Some people review on their blog. So it's great to see the different ways that people are reading and reviewing and what their selections have been.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've been posting reviews on Instagram. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't fully understand Instagram. I mean, I can do a few things on there, but I've never been quite sure how long a post people will tolerate. So I've tried to keep the reviews on there relatively brief, but I've been posting them on there. And I've been able to read more this summer than last summer, which has been good.
That's good.
It's been a lot of fun. So this is the final one, I think, which is going to be nice. I'll post a review on Instagram too when the podcast goes out, I think, as well. So what else have you read for the challenge, Raquel, if this is number three? What was one and two?
So the first book I read was Phantom Lady, Hollywood producer Joan Harrison, the forgotten woman behind Hitchcock by Christina Lane. That was fantastic. Very eye-opening, very insightful and informative. And Joan Harrison was a producer who started as Alfred Hitchcock's assistant and blossomed from there. Was a screenwriter, producer for television, really helped Robert Montgomery with the second kind of phase of his acting career. She did so many things. And it's a very empowering read, too, for women just to see this woman from film history really, you know, carving a space for herself and really forging her own path in the industry, which was very difficult to do at the time. And the other book I read was also very good. Was The Lives of Robert Ryan by J.R. Jones. Also insightful. That's like my word of the day, insightful. I've been getting a lot of insight and context these days, which is wonderful. This has been a really great biography on one of my favorite actors, Robert Ryan. It's really interesting, kind of delves into his career, but also about him being a very private individual, not wanting to be part of the Hollywood machine. And he also addresses his family life, his politics, his activism, his work on the Oakwood School, which is a private school out in Los Angeles. Very, very interesting. So if anyone wants to read either of those books, I highly recommend them.
And am I right in thinking that the Robert Ryan book was kind of a landmark because it was your 100th book review on the website? Is that right?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, that's great. I had noticed when I was organizing my reviews that I had I was on number 99. And then when I finished this book, I was like, officially, this is my 100th book review on my blog. So yes, that was very exciting.
Yeah, it's quite a milestone, I think. Well, here's to the next 100, I think. Let's keep going. Yeah, I'll just tell people what I've been reading quickly. I don't want to spend too long on this because there's a few. But so the first one I read was called Heavenly Bodies by Richard Dyer. So this book, kind of an academic book, really, about film stars. In particular, he talks about Marilyn Monroe, Paul Robeson, and Judy Garland. And he talks about the way different audiences might sort of regard them differently. So he talks about how Garland had this particular status for gay men, for instance. So I think it's a very good scholarly book. I'm not sure it would appeal to everyone, but I think if you like any of those particular performers, you'll get a lot from it. So I learned a lot about Paul Robeson, for instance, which I didn't know before. So I enjoyed that.
It sounds interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. The second one was called The Age of Movies, Selected Writings of Pauline Kael, edited by Sanford Schwartz. So just a compilation of some of Pauline Kael's best reviews and pieces. She has a very forthright style, which I really like to read him. Even, or maybe especially, when she comes up with something where I completely disagree with her. Like, she talks about how you can't really think of Clint Eastwood as a bad actor because he's hardly an actor at all. And I really like Clint Eastwood, so I thought it was a bit unfair, but I enjoyed reading the piece. I don't know, Raquel, did you say to me you wanted to read more of Pauline Kael's work? I remember you saying that to me.
Yes, I saw your review on Instagram and I made note to get that book because I've read like some of her reviews here and there, and it's some of them can be very shocking. Just in terms of her insights into what the film's potential is, and that we understand later on, or even just some observations that are complete, that seem like from left field. She's a very opinionated reviewer, and I really want to learn more about her. She's a very important film critic.
Yeah, it's weird because when people are like super opinionated sometimes on Twitter, it kind of turns me off. But with Kael, I really enjoyed it. And when she's really on fire, like I think I mentioned in the review, her piece on Bonnie and Clyde was particularly good. You know, when she's on fire, she's great. So yeah, I'd recommend that if people are interested. And it goes, you know, it spans a few decades. So from her early career, 50s and 60s, up to the late 80s, I think. I read a couple of books as preparation for the Psycho podcast I did. I think this is why I've been able to get 5 in already so far, Raquel.
Impressive.
Yeah. So the first one was called Hitchcock's Films Revisited by Robin Wood. Yeah, useful for podcast research, analysis of Hitchcock and some of his best films. The thing I thought was interesting about this was it was basically a new edition of a book that was first written in 1965. I think this version's from 1989. So the first half of the book is the old book, Hitchcock's Films, kind of reprinted. But what was fun about it was because Robin Wood provided new endnotes, and obviously he's revisiting it 25 years later, and he thinks differently about some of these things now. So some of the endnotes were funny, kind of like, not in these terms exactly, but kind of like, oh my God, what was I thinking here when I wrote this, you know? And you don't often see that. I always think it's interesting to see how a writer thinks about their own work kind of later down the line. So I enjoyed that one, and it was a useful research book. The next one was called A Long Hard Look at Psycho by Raymond Dergnat. Now, this was an exhaustive, in-depth analysis of Psycho, scene by scene. Each scene was kind of taken apart from various perspectives. He goes into like painstaking detail about the smallest things, like how the camera moves, how the lighting is set up, which dialogue was cut from the script, and all of this. So if you enjoyed Psycho, if you enjoyed my 8 podcasts related to Psycho and you want more, I think that's a good book to check out because it goes really deep on the film.
And you did a great job with your series. That was really interesting to listen to. It was a great deep dive, and I'm glad I was part of it. And it definitely encouraged me to watch Psycho and really think about it more. So that's it. That's really great that you were able to find those resources and really do a deep dive.
Yeah, thank you. And I really enjoyed those. There was a nice challenge, those podcasts. Like, how can I make this interesting? And it seems like a few people enjoyed it, so I'm glad of that. The final book then, before this one, was Love, Lucy by Lucille Ball, which I've had for a while. I bought it secondhand. It's an interest. The backstory to the book is arguably a bit more interesting than the book itself, because the book was an abandoned project. Lucille Ball working on this memoir with a co-writer in the 60s. And then for whatever reason, it's not quite clear, but she kind of put it aside. And she, of course, never wrote an autobiography at the end of her life. And then this manuscript was found after her death by her family and ultimately published. So it's an interesting one. It seemed a bit sanitized to me. It was quite breezy and it raced through things pretty quickly. Having said that, I think Lucille Ball's voice comes through enough to make it. I mean, if you're a fan of hers and you haven't read it, I think it's worth a go. I'd say about 2/3 of it are devoted to her film career. And then the rest of it is like the I Love Lucy series and so on.
Oh, interesting. That one, I flipped through that one to use it for research, just to see if she had mentioned, you know, working on certain things or working with certain people. But I haven't read it all the way through. Yeah. So I'm interested in picking that one up. You got to be careful with memoirs. Like, as you said, sometimes they're too sanitized, or sometimes they're just trying to tell a story. I was doing research on Norma Shearer, and she had tried to write her own memoir. And Janet Leigh, who was Norma Shearer's discovery, she helped her become an actress, said it read like a storybook. It was very like fictionalized. And sometimes you just, that's not good.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just want to go with a biography instead.
Yeah. Sometimes you want that detachment almost. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Too. Okay. So that's what I've read so far for the reading challenge. And
that's great.
Yeah, I'm happy to have done so much so far this summer. It's good, and I really enjoyed it. Okay, let's talk a bit about Letters from Hollywood then, the book we're here to talk about specifically. So, as the title suggests, this is a selection of letters and other types of written correspondence too, written by people from within the film industry, spanning from 1921 up to 1976. It includes dozens of letters. I'm not sure exactly how many, but it's a lot of letters, isn't it, Rick? It's a lot of stuff.
Yes, a lot. This must have taken so long to curate and then put together, because it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, I think so. And all sorts of figures included. So I'll just rattle off a few names, but I could go on and on. But let's say from William Wyler, Boris Karloff, Greta Garbo, Alfred Hitchcock, Frank Sinatra, Ginger Rogers, up to more contemporary figures towards the end of the book. You got people like Tom Hanks and Jane Fonda towards the end. So you get their letters. You also get some explanatory text that gives you some of the context, some of the biographical information about who these people are, because they're not all household names necessarily. And the book comes with a foreword by Peter Bogdanovich. So Raquel, I guess the best place to start is just in very general terms, general thoughts. Like, is this a good book? Is this something we would recommend that people go out and spend their hard-earned money on?
Well, if you're going to spend money on a book like this, which is a larger format, sort of like a coffee table book, but a little more compact, you want to look at the quality of it. I mean, the content, I think, is really good in terms of, you know, the breadth and scope of it. It goes from 1921 to 1976. You really get a good range of letters and missives, and the way it's produced is really wonderful, because you get to see the entire letter. You get to see like the scan of the Western Union telegram, or the letter on the hotel letterhead. It's handwritten notes, it's typewritten notes, it's sometimes letters with illustrations. What's wonderful about it is you get to see the entire thing, and where it's not readable, they have it printed out. So I thought that was really great. It's very readable, visually very stunning. And the publisher, Abrams, is known for really wonderful photography books and all sorts of illustrated books. So they do a really good job. This book physically is just gorgeous. If you let me geek out about book stuff, because I've been in the book industry many years, so this is one of the things I love to do. It's got a beautiful cover. The self cover, which is the cover underneath the dust jacket, is plain, but it has like an old fashioned stamp on it, which I thought was really nice. When you open it up, the end papers, which when you open a hardcover book, the first thing you see, is called the end papers. And in this case, it's an old fashioned illustration of Los Angeles and the surrounding suburbs. So, and then you have film stars drawn in. So you see, I pointed out like the Marx Brothers and Clark Gable, and I think Joan Blondell, I spotted her in there. It's fun just to like look through it and see if you can identify the stars in the different, and the different suburbs and areas. And then, the book itself is really well made. One point is with books like this, you want to lay them on their back, like they're sitting on a coffee table, because it's a little heavy, not very heavy, but it's a little heavy. So the block of paper can't pull from the spine, but this is actually sewn into the spine. And that's a good thing because that will make it last longer. And I note this because the book in the United States retails at $40. So that's a pricey book. So you want to make sure it's good quality. So I feel for its price and what you get content-wise, which is just really an amazing collection of letters from all sorts of people, from not only the actors, actresses, directors, but people below the line as well. Screenwriters, agents, production managers. There was even a montage director. And then even people on the periphery, like gossip columnists or, you know, censors and all sorts of people. So you really get lots of insight through the collection. So I think overall, both physically and content-wise, it's really good.
So, yeah, because we've both got the hardcover book, but of course people have the option of getting the Kindle version or whatnot. Now, I'm a very kind of tactile person when it comes to books. I like having books around me. I like that feeling of approaching the end of the book because you sort of turn, you know, there are fewer and fewer pages left to turn. I never felt quite the same when I'm reading on a tablet and it's like a percentage count or whatever. So I'll be honest, I'm always going to recommend getting a physical copy of something. But I think this book in particular is a nice object to have, isn't it?
Yes.
So you're similar, I think. You always sort of prefer that sort of physical experience with a book. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, if this would be okay to get on a Kindle if it was just a collection of printed letters, like if it was just annotated. And there are books like that. There are collections of letters and missives that are like I have, for example, I have one like the selected letters of like Ilya Kazan. I have one on like memos by David O. Selznick. Those would be fine on Kindle. But the visual aspect of Letters from Hollywood is what's the most appealing. Seeing the different letters, and there's like so many small details, like the tape that held the paper together, the rust from where the staple was at one point. The little hand-drawn illustrations, you know, the little mistakes, the crossing off and the folds and the, you know, the wear, the age. That's very charming. And we don't have physical access to these letters, but this is kind of the next best thing is to be able to see a scan of them in a really nice presentation. And you'll lose that with a Kindle version.
Yeah, I enjoyed this book a lot. You know, I found it a relatively quick read. And I think the reason for that is I think there was a lot of, you know, just one more letter kind of thinking going on.
Oh, yes.
As in, you know, there were times when I really felt like I should stop and go and do something else. But I kept thinking, well, I'll just read one more, you know. And then, of course, one becomes two, becomes three. And there you go. So I thought it was very engaging. I thought it was easy to engage with. You know, there were times when I'd be sat there for an hour or more reading. But there were other times when I'd just grab a few minutes here and there. You know, I'd be waiting for the kettle to boil. And I'd think, well, I'll just read a letter.
And they can be read on their own, which is really interesting. Yeah. You can dip in and out of it very easily because the authors do such a great job at giving you context on each one, even if it's repetitive. Even if you had just read about, you know, that particular subject a few pages ago, the text reminds you again, just in case maybe you had put the book down for a while and came back and just started with that letter. So yep. You get all the context. So it is, I mean, as you said, you do want to read one more letter because they're so interesting, but it also serves really well if you just want to dip in and out of it once in a while.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point, because I think people will engage with this in different ways. I think there'll be people who really pore over this and study the handwriting, and other people who dip in and out, or you can just read the letters of particular people that interest you, or if you're researching somebody, you want to pull up a letter, or you can go cover to cover, which is the way I've done it. I've read everything.
Same.
Yeah. What do we think about the approach that Hall and Lang took here then? And in particular, I was thinking about things like, the annotations that are included alongside the letters. Like, did you find those particularly useful?
Yes, I thought in some instances you kind of needed the context to even understand what was being discussed. Like, I'll give an example. Like, there's a letter from Will Rogers to Cecil B. DeMille, kind of turning him down for a role in one of the DeMille films. And there's some inside jokes in there that you kind of need some context on. So the annotations really help because it gives you some of that information. And especially when it's the below the line crew, maybe names we're not familiar with. We might be familiar with some producers, but not all. We might not be familiar with screenwriters or maybe some of the more obscure people. So that really helps. Sometimes I would just go and look for their name first just to figure out who this person was, because I had never heard of them. So for me, it ended up being essential. If I had just read some of these letters on their own without any sort of background information, I might not have fully appreciated them. Although some you can read and completely understand on their own. But then there's also like nicknames and all sorts of like maybe vague references that made sense at the time, and some terminology and some words that you kind of need the help with. So that to me, I thought, really added to the book.
Yeah, like a good example of that I pulled out was, there's a letter from Joseph M. Schenck, who's the 20th Century Fox executive, and he makes an analogy in his letter about chickens and eggs, which seemed kind of puzzling until you read the annotation and it's pointed out this is probably a reference to food rationing.
Yes.
Which was an issue at the time. Yeah, I found the annotations really useful, I got to say.
Yes.
From the very first letter of the book. The first letter of the book is Harry Houdini writing to Adolf Zukor, who's the head of the famous players Lasky Corporation. And the letter's quite matter of fact. It's not that I didn't understand it, but the annotations pointed out, well, Houdini's probably trying to impress him here, because he compares his film to another film. And, things like that, where I didn't quite grasp all the finer context.
I mean, these letters didn't exist in a vacuum at the time. They were responses to things. They were part of conversations. Sometimes they were follow-ups to phone calls and things like that. But for us, we're completely removed from that. So that context that the annotations give, help us kind of put it in the scope of what's happening in the world of these figures from film history.
Yeah, and sometimes what isn't said is almost more interesting than what is.
Yes.
So one I particularly noted was Lou Marangello, who's a publicist. He writes a letter to Irving Folberg about the filming of a 1925 Ben-Hur.
Yes.
And it glosses over all manner of production problems. The letter just doesn't refer to any of them, but the fact that all these animals were killed on the set. There's one sequence that maybe resulted in the death of like several extras. There's this big chariot race that they filmed where the footage ended up being unusable. And you wouldn't know any of that from the letter, because it's a very kind of, it's a letter that serves a certain purpose. So yeah, really, really helpful, those annotations, I think.
That's one of my favorites, because right off the bat, the annotation tells you this is a really good publicist because he's hiding all sorts of things that are happening on the set. And also the visually, it's stunning. It's something that probably doesn't exist anymore, is production branded letterhead. This one says on the top Ben-Hur, and it has the major figures from MGM, and it has Ben-Hur and the chariot race at the bottom, and the whip kind of travels all the way around the letter. It's quite beautiful, and it was really fun to see some of those details show up. How people during the production of a film would actually write to other people on official production letterhead. That was really fascinating too.
Yeah. And another thing I appreciate about their approach to the book is the inclusion of the transcripts for most, I think most of the handwritten letters. I think there might be one exception where they don't include one.
Yes, I was wondering if that was an error. That comes at the very end of the book, and I couldn't read it. I had a I had a difficult time. I tried, but I think that might have been an error. They might have meant to include something there.
Well, no, I'm glad you said that. It's not just me who finds it really hard to read people's handwriting, because I was reading this book, and you know, we were recording this weekend, so we had to finish it by a certain time. I tended to just read the transcript, to be honest, and only really glance at those handwritten originals. At the same time, and like you kind of already said, but it's great that those handwritten letters are there, isn't it? Like, it's really interesting to see all the kind of mistakes and the additions and the crossings out and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I don't know how you engage with it, Raquel. I think there'll be certain people who are particularly interested in like their favorite star's handwriting, and they'll kind of scrutinize it. But like I say, I didn't spend an age kind of poring over that stuff. I kind of raced through it. I was glad of the transcript.
Yeah, no, I definitely read the transcript and then would spend maybe a little time just looking over the actual letter, maybe noting the handwriting. I know, for example, like with the Errol Flynn letter to Lewis Milestone, I just wanted to see how people wrote swear words. And he does swear in that one. And I just kind of like out of curiosity wanted to see how it was written. It's just a very small thing. But yeah, I wanted to see the details, like, you know, what their handwriting was like, what their signature was like, what the paper was like. I would take a glance at it, but definitely I think I only tried to read one handwritten letter. I think it was the Fatty Arbuckle one. I just made an attempt. It took me way too long. I was like, no, I'll skip this.
Well, it's also great seeing like the typos on the typed letters, isn't it? Like, there was one.
There's
Constance
so many.
Collier. Yeah, but the one I made a note of was Constance Collier writes the word tyrant as triant, which is just a little thing, but it's nice seeing those things. It's interesting.
Or interesting how sometimes they didn't always get names correctly. Yeah. Like Dorothy Arzner writing to Preston Sturges, and she misspells his last name. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. Lots of like typos, or seeing where the typewriter went back to fix something, or when they go in and handwrite something in a typewritten letter just to add missing words or some extra context. I love that stuff.
Okay, so in his foreword, Peter Bogdanovich says that this is a delightfully intimate and illuminating way to learn about Hollywood history. So what do you think about that? Like, how well do you think the book does capture Hollywood history, the ways in which the film industry changed over time? Because obviously it's not attempting to tell kind of the whole story, is it? But you do get a sense of all that stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I think this book is maybe more insightful than it is informative. Like, you get more of a deeper sense of what's happening on with the movie colony, as it's referred to several times in the book. What I think I appreciate about it the most is the fact that it does kind of show more about the below the line crew, because we think, like, especially when we read biographies on actors or directors, we don't necessarily find out much about, I mean, we might learn something about what the producers are doing, but we might not know what the costume designer is toiling over, or how the screenwriter is trying to fix the script so that it can pass the production code. Like, there's some things that are offered here that we don't get in other in other traditional maybe biographies. So I think in many ways this is like a deeper insight. So if people who maybe are very informed about Hollywood history want maybe a different perspective, this would be very good. And Peter Bogdanovich has a very, very flowery foreword, I think. So he did, like, this has definitely has his stamp of approval.
Yeah. One of the things I liked was, I mean, you get things do come up, like, you know, the coming of sound or color kind of replacing black and white, and the 3D fad and stuff like that. Like I said, it doesn't tell the whole story, but what's kind of fun about it, I thought, is that obviously it's a snapshot. So these things that are coming, they don't feel kind of inevitable to some of these people. So there's a letter from Ronald Colman.
Yes.
To studio executive A. Blair in 1928. And Colman's very skeptical about sound, isn't he? He says, And this is a quote: "I am not sympathetic to this sound business," and he puts "sound" in quotation marks. "I feel, as so many do, that it is a mechanical resource, that it is a retrogressive and temporary digression insofar as it affects the art of motion picture acting." So I thought that was interesting, because whenever we hear the history of Hollywood, sometimes these things do seem a bit kind of inevitable, but obviously at the time they weren't. So that's kind of fun, I thought, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, there were some kind of eye-opening observations that now, knowing the history of everything, it seems kind of backwards. Like, there was Robert E. Sherwood, who was one of the screenwriters on The Best Year of Our Lives, and he was trying to convince Samuel Goldwyn to maybe rethink making the film because, oh, by the time this comes out, World War II vets will be over their trauma. And now we know that that's not accurate. And this, you know, this absolutely amazing film went on to win a bunch of Academy Awards, still recognized as one of the best World War II films. So we're glad that Samuel Goldwyn didn't listen to him.
Yeah.
But there are observations that are quite shocking. Or maybe, like, in the context of the time, they didn't realize, you know, what was coming in the future, or what they had for their vision. I think there was one by Irving Berlin where he's talking about his song and he was surprised how much of a hit it was. Things like that are really interesting because we take that stuff for granted now.
Definitely. Yeah, it's fun to see some of those things. And like, sometimes there are these predictions and to see how they measure up to what actually happened. Like, there was one from Humphrey Bogart to John Huston. This is 1952. And Bogart says, "I'm informed by the people with know-how and great vision that within a very few years, there'll be practically no black and white pictures exhibited." So he's kind of suggesting that Huston shoots Beat the Devil in color, mm-hmm. I think. So it's kind of fun there. Like, he wasn't that far off. It was a few years, but eventually it did happen, of course. I think you get some of the back and forth over things like the code. I thought that was interesting in some letters. You get these references to things like the House Un-American Activities Committee, don't you? You never get like the full story.
That was a huge theme throughout the whole book, was the blacklist and how it affected so many careers. And you kind of get it through right before the blacklist, during the blacklist, and after the blacklist, and then beyond, because careers really adversely affected. And one of the another theme throughout the book I thought was really interesting is the power struggle of getting credit, especially, you know, for screenwriters. If they had maybe taken over a project or had worked on something and had to share credit or didn't get credit at all, and how there was that battle for recognition. And that goes on throughout the whole book. That's something I wouldn't necessarily have gotten from just a traditional biography or another book, but you really get insights into how important it was, because the subjects in these letters, they're putting their, you know, blood, sweat, and tears into these projects, and it's very important for them to get their credit, you know, to get recognized for their work. So I thought that was also a really interesting ongoing theme through the whole book.
Yeah, and you get things, don't you, like Bette Davis, for instance, kind of fighting the system. And then, of course, as the book wears on, as the years go by, you get kind of the breakdown of the old studio system. So you get this interesting thing towards the end of the book when you're getting people like Francis Ford Coppola, who are coming along at a time they're sort of coexisting with some older figures. And then, of course, you get into the 70s and things have changed quite dramatically.
Right.
So I think one of the things Barbara Hall says, I think it's her in the introduction, she says that the book kind of shows how things have changed and how some things are still the same, you know.
Yes.
Like, did you feel that about some of the letters, that there are these things that are written in like 1920, whatever, or whenever it might be, but a lot of the concerns are still kind of current today in some ways? I don't know. Did you get that sense at all?
Yeah, there were several letters about how movies were changing and how things from the like the old way of making movies is kind of a lost art. That's still going on today. There's still a struggle, like, especially with the changing technology and how films are released, and even with the pandemic now, how we don't know how films will be made after this, and what has been running before, how that's going to work in the future. So that fear of the future is something we still have today. And just even some observations, like I thought it was there was a really nice letter from Fred Astaire talking about how wonderful Rebecca was. It's still a wonderful film. We still love it. So there's things that outlast, you know, the years. So, yeah, there's a lot of observations. And then there's also lots of backward ones as well.
Yes, that's true. In terms of what stayed the same, I liked the kind of sense of, I want to call it kind of hustling that you get through the book.
Yes.
So I mentioned people like Houdini's letter, where he's trying to kind of get ahead or trying to achieve something. And I think that runs all the way through the book, doesn't it? So for instance, there's an interesting letter from Bela Lugosi. So I'm going to give another shout out to Vanessa Patino here, because I know she loves Bela Lugosi. And he writes a letter to an agent, Harold Friedman, where it's clear how much he wants the lead role in the film version of Dracula. And he's basically saying, if you have any great parts, send them my way, that kind of thing. And that runs all the way through. Like, there's the Tom Hanks letter I mentioned in 1974, where he writes to the director, George Roy Hill, who just made The Sting. And it's a funny letter, and it's all about how Hill should discover Hanks and make him a star, you know.
And there's a reply, too, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and like, Hanks's letter is quite charming and funny. Yes. But you also do kind of feel that ambition coming through, don't you? So you sort of see, you know, people trying to get ahead, like, all the way through. That doesn't change.
That is a huge theme throughout the whole book. And one of the reasons I loved reading these letters is these are really hardworking people, very passionate about what they do. So that, to me, was interesting. And one thing, too, just to touch back on something that kind of is still happening today, is I was very struck by Dorothy Arzner, who was one of the only female directors working in the 40s. Her career at that point was, like, winding down, and she really wanted to become a film executive. So she writes this letter to Preston Sturges, basically pitching herself. And that's something, too, women in the business really had to fight for work. And that's still a struggle for women filmmakers. So I thought that was interesting. That's something we can look back on with this letter and still see kind of the struggle today, how there's still these wonderful female film directors, but they're still struggling to find more work. So I thought that was super interesting.
And I guess in terms of things that are current today, I mean, Gone with the Wind is still heavily debated today. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of nice that in the book you get a letter from Hattie McDaniel, you know, because a lot of people have debated that role and just various things about Gone with the Wind. But you get a sense from her letter about how proud she was of her work and stuff like that. Okay, so you mentioned the phrase movie colony earlier, like the movie colony of LA. And yeah, that's what Barbara Hall says in the intro, is that that's what many of these letters do. They provide that look at that kind of life. So did you feel the book had a nice balance between, obviously, lots of these letters look at the industry. Some of them are more about the personal lives, aren't they? Did you think it was a nice mix of those kind of things?
I like that it leaned heavily on the business aspect of things. So there was a lot of information about maybe the nuances of a script, getting it through the censors, production issues, even like the aftermath, like, some of the letters are just all out battles. Like, there was one really brutal letter from Irving Thalberg to Eric von Stryom, like basically firing him. Yeah. And it goes on and on and on. I thought that was super interesting. So I like that it kind of leans heavily on the business side, but there are so many really wonderful personal letters that I thought were lovely, just really complimentary letters. Like, there's this really sweet one from Ingrid Bergman to Cary Grant, because she had heard about winning her Oscar through a radio broadcast, and she happened to be in the bathroom at the time. And there's this really charming, so it's related to, you know, something that happened to her work-wise, but it's this really sweet letter to, you know, her co-star and her friend. And there's some that are just fluff, but they're wonderful. And it's almost like a palate cleanser through the book. Like, there's one from Louis Calhern, and it's just joke after joke. And I was laughing out loud reading it. And he's writing to a columnist, and he's just telling all these really funny, like, stories that, you know, are not necessarily true, but they're just amusing. And it's great after reading kind of some serious pieces to kind of get some of those thrown in, and some, like, really charming, well-written letters. And letter writing is a lost art. So it's kind of really interesting to read the voice and the language in these.
Yeah, you mentioned the Irving Thalberg letter. That struck me as well, the one where he fires von Stroheim. And
yes.
Because I was wondering, because that's early on in the book, I was wondering, are we going to get things in here which, you know, refer to significant events and things? And that seemed like an interesting one to me. But you definitely get a sense of, like, how relentless the Hollywood schedule could be. Like, there's a Greg Toland letter, the cinematographer. He writes to Fred Zinnemann, and he talks about he finished a film at MGM, then he did 7 weeks working on Tarzan, then he's getting ready for another film. He's travelled 4,400 miles in 3 weeks doing things. And with some people, you come away thinking how busy they must have been all the time, you know.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like, there was one letter, I'm struggling to remember who it was. It was a composer. And the annotation made a point that composers are under, like, a really strict schedule because the film is, you know, ready to go, and there's like a release date that they're hoping to get to, and you have to come up with all this original music, and the movie really depends on the music, you know, for so many things. So there's all this pressure, and that's something that I didn't quite understand or appreciate before.
On the more social side of things, on that side, you get things like Jack Warner writes a letter to another producer about a gambling debt. So you do get a sense of how things like poker games are this big social activity, about how they were taken seriously and about how they could have ramifications if things go wrong. Like, Warner's basically saying, look, you've got this debt you haven't paid. You need to straighten it out, you know. And then there's one from Dashiell Hammett where he writes about, he's just writing about various things like concerts and William Wyler's throwing a cocktail party and he's seen all these people at these various clubs and things. So you get this sense of, I think you do get a sense of how the social scene worked as well to some extent. And some of the letters show how those things are kind of inseparable, don't they? Like, you get some sense of scandal in the book with things like Fatty Arbuckle, don't you? And how the studios controlled their stars and things like that, which is all really interesting too.
It's interesting because these people were really good friends. They were, you know, they spent time together. So you get that aspect. You get the work aspect and you get the personal aspect, which I thought was interesting. And that what you mentioned, the Fatty Arbuckle letter was like fascinating and how he's, you know, and we know what's going to happen after, but it's really interesting how they try to, like, he tried to really defend himself in that piece. And, like, you get that. Like, you get, there's a lot of personal, because the personal and the professional are really tied together in this business.
Yeah, because his letter is basically, I think he's been released on bail at that point. Mm-hmm. He's been accused of rape and murder. And what he's basically saying is that his celebrity status has led him to become a scapegoat in that one. So right. Yeah, I thought that was fascinating too. Another one I found fascinating was, it's from Sol Wurzel, who's the head of production at Fox, and he's writing to the actress Madge Bellamy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically saying, well, I've seen a photograph of you in a magazine or somewhere. It looks like you've gained a few pounds. And he basically tells her to go on a diet.
That's so awful. Yeah,
it is. But we know that kind of thing went on and goes on, most likely. But to see it on the page like that is interesting, isn't it?
It's true. And then I think that one is maybe one of the most shocking to me, but the absolute most shocking of the book was Jean Bellow, who was Jean Harlow's mother. She was notoriously a very involved and kind of crazy mother of a star. She writes a letter to her daughter's agent, Arthur Lando, about the making of Bombshell and how, like, oh, you know, they weren't complimentary enough to Jean Harlow. They didn't pay enough attention to her. And she calls her the baby. And the agent is called the Pop or Pops. And it's just, like, it's cringeworthy. And I know that you'll if you do any kind of deep dive on Jean Harlow, you'll learn more about her mother's control over her life, which is very unfortunate. But in this, you kind of get it from, you know, the horse's mouth, in a sense. You know, you get it from actual her, you hear her voice. So I thought that was super interesting and kind of shocking. But yeah, you get that throughout throughout the book. Not too many like that, but that one in particular stood out.
Yeah, there are some that stand out like that, definitely. So what Rocky Lang says in his intro is he wanted to preserve the voice of the letter writer and the time they lived as seen through their writing. And you've already kind of mentioned this idea of the lost art of letter writing, and it's really true, isn't it? Like,
yes,
it's interesting to me as someone who grew up kind of as email was becoming more prominent, and like these days through work, I come into contact with younger people who just think of email now as unbelievably kind of archaic, you know. So I'd love to know what they make of this, but I don't know, it's like the sense of thought that has to go into writing a letter is kind of different, isn't it? Like in the best letters, you really get a sense of an individual sensibility that they bring to it. You know, some of them have quite obviously had a lot of care and attention on what they've written. So I don't know, there's something very nice about how tangible these letters are, isn't there? And it is a lost art, I think, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and some of these letters, well, actually all of them have a really interesting purpose to them. Some of them are written in a way to maybe massage an ego. Some of them are to defend themselves. Some of them are to make a new connection, to, as you said earlier, to network, to hustle. So yeah, there's a really clear voice. And I feel like if we only got a snippet of the letter, or maybe the letter was just described to us, it wouldn't be the same as actually reading it all the way through and really kind of getting that voice. Cause you get a sense too, like there, I think there was a letter from Kirk Douglas to a director, I think, it was for Detective Story, and he's kind of playful in his language. And I think is just trying to be careful about maybe they didn't get along on set, but maybe he wants to work with him again. So some of that happens, and you see that. And there's you had mentioned the Hattie McDaniel letter. I believe that was to Hedda Hopper, and she's very careful in her language in that one. And that one is because Hedda Hopper had complained about the NAACP's campaign for better roles for African American actors, and McDaniel is basically sending a very pleasant rebuttal. She doesn't want to basically piss off this, you know, huge gossip columnist who's got this amazing platform that really, you know, affects like the readers. But then we learn in the annotation how Hedda Hopper basically cut and paste parts of Hattie McDaniel's letter to make it seem like she was agreeing with Hedda Hopper. So it's really interesting once you, like, if maybe you had, like, we had read what Hedda Hopper had published versus the actual letter from Hattie McDaniel, we wouldn't have realized the whole context of things. So I think it's really important to read the whole piece and really get some sense of their voice and what's happening. But then, yeah, there are things that are cleverly hidden or suggested through language, through whether it's a joke or very carefully plotted out language or very complimentary tones, things like that.
Yeah, Hedda Hopper, she also comes up at another point, or at least one other point, doesn't she? There's an interesting exchange with Katharine Hepburn.
Yes.
Where it's kind of like, can we be friends? She kind of says to Hepburn, and Hepburn's kind of like, well, a lot of time has passed or whatever.
And Katharine Hepburn, like, adds, like, a reference at the very end that kind of hits home that she's still putting Hedda Hopper at a distance because of something that happened in the past. And I love those sort of things. They're very subtle. And the annotation helps give you context on those things because we might not completely understand them. But it does show how letter writing is an art that it's not very direct. It's an art form that has, you know, its nuances and subtleties.
Definitely, because I think, yeah, I mean, we've mentioned maybe some of the different types of paper you see and things like that, which might sound trivial. That adds another layer of enjoyment. And like some of these people like Colonel Tom Parker have this very elaborate headed paper and things like that. But the one I was most struck by wasn't headed paper as such, but the montage director, Peter Bulbush. He writes a letter to Charles Laughton, and it's got these beautiful drawings on it. I think he's drawn like ballerinas and a butterfly and things like that. Now, not every letter is distinctive in that way. I'm not saying that, but quite a few of them are. You know, you do get a nice sense of individuality from some of these letters. I think some of these people did excel at this art of letter writing. I also enjoyed learning about things like V-mail in this book, which was, I hadn't heard of that, but it was used by the US government in the war. It's where people in the military wrote their letters on special forms, which were then taken to America on microfilm. So it was meant to reduce the volume of mail and stuff like that. So I learned some things from this book, definitely.
And I do like looking at the old Western Union telegrams and seeing those little strips of paper that would just come out, and they would cut them to size and then paste them onto the telegrams. Some of those small details are just really fun to kind of pore over. And as you said, we learn things that, you know, are not relevant to today, but it's interesting with the context, like the references to rationing, things like that are just really, really interesting.
So I don't know if you mentioned, like you mentioned at least one of your personal favorite letters, but I've picked out a few that I particularly enjoyed. Did you have some personal favorites, Raquel?
Oh yeah, I had a lot of them. There's so many wonderful ones. There's this really funny kind of lettered from Boris Karloff. He's writing to writer Albert Hergesheimer, basically giving him some information, some quirky information for the gossip magazines, because they would do that, like they would try to get some like interesting trivia bits from stars so they can include them for magazines to kind of add some fun behind the scenes context. And he writes to tell him that on the set of Frankenstein, every time he left the makeup room, he would turn right. And he saw that it ended up being good luck for him. So every time he leaves the makeup room now, he turns right for, you know, and I thought that was kind of sweet. There was a really nice letter from David Niven to Samuel Goldwyn. And this was in 1939. The United States wasn't in World War II yet, but David Niven was from England, so he wanted to return to England to help with the war effort. And this is just very sweet missive to Samuel Goldwyn, thanking him for his help in his career and talking a little bit about what's, you know, hopefully the war will end and things like that. And I thought that was really eye-opening because, you know, he didn't know if he was going to come back. He didn't know what the future held. No one knew. So I thought that was quite poignant. I was really moved by that. And if you don't mind, I'm going to point out a few more.
Yeah, go for it.
The one that you had mentioned earlier about Betty Davis writing to Jack Warner, demanding better work conditions, asking for just two films, maybe three films a year maximum with some time to rest in between. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is at a time where, you know, the studios had really severe control over their stars, and Betty Davis was one of the first to really fight against that. So I thought that was super interesting. And then probably one of the most charming exchanges in the whole book is Henry Fonda's Western Union telegram to William Wyler on the birth of Jane Fonda. And Henry Fonda does it in the voice of newborn Jane Fonda, and then William Wyler responds to Jane, and it's just the cutest thing. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but read it. It's just like, it'll put a smile on your face.
I think the thing with this book is that everybody will have different favorites, because like the ones you mentioned there, that they don't really overlap with mine, but they're all great, you know. So I just wanted to mention a few. So you've already referred to the Irving Berlin letter to Mark Sandrich, which yeah, it's so fascinating. Berlin trying to make sense of why the song White Christmas has become such a big hit. And he says, I personally didn't believe it could be, you know, and like the reaction shows differently. And I like that one, kind of what you said before, for that reason that it's almost hard to imagine a time when that song wasn't so totemic. So that letter is a snapshot of when it was becoming iconic. Another one I liked was Joseph Stefano to Janet Leigh. And just because I keep finding new things about Psycho since I've stopped recording those episodes. I just keep coming across stuff, you know. Basically, a very generous letter. Stefano talks about how brilliant he thought Janet Leigh was in the film, which is really nice. And I've chosen what's actually probably the shortest letter in the book as another favourite, but I'm a big James Bond fan. And in the book, you get the producer, Cubby Broccoli, to his producing partner, Harry Saltzman. I think it's a telex rather than a letter, actually. But it's just two lines about what Universal Artists head of production thought about the idea of casting Sean Connery as Bond. You know, he didn't care for him. He feels we can do better. And that's it. But just funny as kind of a fork in the road, because of course it didn't happen. And, or, you know, Connery did get the part rather, and it went really well. And then what, 25 films later, you know, the Bond franchise is still going.
That was short and powerful, I have to say. Yeah. Can I just mention one more that I thought was really charming? Was Paul Newman writing to William Wyler and producer Ray Stark, turning down the part in Funny Girl, because he was like, yeah, that's I can't sing, I can't dance, it's not right, you know, find someone else for this part. It was just really charming the way he wrote it.
Yeah, well, I wanted to mention a few letters that were particularly funny or surprising, and I picked out that one because I thought this quote was really funny. He says, when he's talking about how he can't dance, he says, I have no flexibility below the ass at all. I even have difficulty proving the paternity of my six children. And I like that. Humphrey Bogart's letter I mentioned earlier was pretty funny too, because it starts by saying, Bogart to Houston, because I always open my wife's mail, I read your insidious and immoral proposals to my wife. And he goes on and he says, as soon as you're perfectly sure that she is knocked up by me, that is, you can offer her a part, basically. He had a funny kind of letter-writing voice. And some of them are quite gossipy. Like, there's one from Joan Crawford where she talks about how she's been at this presentation. She's been presented to the Queen of England and Princess Margaret. And it sounded like Crawford was not happy about who else was in the group. You know, she talks about Marilyn Monroe as Marilyn You-Know-Who.
That was hilarious.
And she talks about Anita Ekberg, and she says... She seems to relish, doesn't she, passing on these details about how Monroe and Ekberg had this embarrassingly tight clothing and people laughed at them and stuff like that.
Which I guess you would expect from Joan Crawford, so that sort of fit her personality.
So basically, there is some funny stuff in this book and some surprising things.
And that does help liven it up, because after reading, like, the Irving Thalberg one really stood out to me. Or all the letters to Joseph Breen trying to defend or at least like negotiate different aspects of scripts, and you know that things have to be kind of watered down or shifted, and you start to think about what could have been with certain film productions. So it's nice to get once in a while like a funny, amusing letter to just have a little palate cleanser.
Yeah, because you get the odd letter that's like 4 or 5 handwritten pages long, don't you? Or a bit longer than the average. And you're right, the variety helps, I think, in this book. Do you think there's scope for more? Like, do you think we could have like a more letters from Hollywood? Would you want more?
Absolutely, I would want more. I think the major issue I had with this is that it was kind of like all over the place, because it goes from the early 1920s to the 1970s. But I guess it makes sense as a book to have the kind of scope, and it can only be so long, and there's quite a lot in here. But I would have loved to have seen maybe a series of these books with like one dedicated to the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. You could do one per decade, or even I would be happy with just one follow-up volume, like a volume 2 that just had and like maybe covered the same time span, but with just additional letters and telegrams and things. I would totally get that, because this was really interesting. I mean, this is not a book I would necessarily use for research. This is more for enjoyment, but, you know, it is just really interesting, and I haven't read anything quite like it. So, yeah, I would definitely want more.
Yeah, I think Rocky Lang, he wrote in the intro about how this is a book that required thousands of hours of research. Mm. You know, how writing a book like this can be like quicksand is the phrase he used. Barbara Hall also talked about how much of a challenge it was because of things, you know, they talk about how difficult it was to get clearance to use some letters and things like that. So yeah, I'd definitely be interested in seeing a follow-up. It makes you wonder what they've sifted through and decided not to include, you know, when you hear about what a challenge it was and that kind of thing.
It's a monumental task, the work that goes into this, and then the care into scanning all of those pieces so they look really great, and then designing the book. The design of the book is really interesting, how sometimes the annotation is on top of like some white space on a letter, or how it's on a completely different page and really gives you the space to really look at the letter separately. So design wise too, the whole project is a lot of work. So me wanting one for per decade is just, you know, pie in the sky wishing for something, but like a volume 2 would be great if they could maybe piggyback on their previous research.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea that you've mentioned of like one per decade, because I think what they do here is they try to limit it to one letter per person, don't they? I think there are some exceptions, but generally that's what they go for. I guess if you had a book about the 30s, you could maybe have like 4 or 5 letters from the same person. I don't know. I'd be interested in seeing a book like this from a more recent time frame, but I don't know how possible that is. I don't know, you can have tweets from Hollywood.
Or emails.
No, I really enjoyed this book. I would like to see a volume 2 in some way, shape or form. I think that'd be really nice.
Absolutely, I agree.
So I recommend this one. Raquel, anything else about this book that you think needs to be said before we wrap up here?
I would just like to hear from people if they have already read it or picked it up and want to share their thoughts. I definitely want to hear what other people have to say. I would just want to emphasize how beautiful physically this book is and how well made it is. So if you are kind of concerned about the price point, which it is a more expensive book, just know that the quality is really great. So it is a good investment.
Yeah, I also think it'd be great to hear what people think about this book, what your favorite letters are. I think that's one thing I would emphasize is, as much as Raquel and I have mentioned a few of these individual letters, there's a lot here that we haven't even touched on.
Right.
I think. So there's a lot to savor here, definitely. All right, Raquel. So where can people find you online if they'd like to find you and your work?
So if you love classic movies, you can find me at Out of the Past, which is my blog, outofthepastblog.com. I also have a YouTube channel and Facebook page for it. I'm on Twitter at Raquel Stetcher. And I have a new movie blog called kelmovies.com. And I also have an Instagram, which I'm also still trying to figure out. it's at kelmovies. And basically, you can find me anywhere online. I also write for Turner Classic Movies and DVD Netflix. You can find articles on both about classic movies. I just love to talk about film. So I hope you find me online.
Brilliant. Thanks, Raquel.
Thank you. This is great.
All right, so the Movie Palace you can find in all the usual places, mostly on Twitter, which I understand more than Instagram, I think. Instagram, though, as well, and Facebook. I think this will be the last episode just for a short time, just for a few weeks, hopefully. Now that I've come out of the Summer of Psycho, I just need to figure out what films I want to cover next and things like that. So I won't be away for a long time, but don't be surprised if it's a few weeks until the next new episode. But that's it for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Motion pictures.
It feels like a film that is a balm. And I never thought that I would feel that about a Tarantino movie. You know, it is by far his nicest film. You know, if you look at it from that context.
So I've seen it four times now. I saw it on release on the opening weekend. I saw it then over Christmas. And then I saw it about 6 weeks ago. I watched it, and then I watched it again last night because we decided to do this. And I really like this film. I think the things you're talking about, I think it's a great hangout film.
Yeah.
That's what Tarantino's described some of his films as.
Right in the childhood.
They don't see the aliens because they're always in the tripods. And I think...
That would be
the
cool,
setting
though,
like... where the, you know, where post-apocalyptic, they've lost all their technology.
Yeah.
It's become very popular, like very, very popular recently, but this is still prime for a remake, I think. I'd love to see that.
I could see it, yeah, especially with shows that you see now that Ryan Austin got to his comeback and stuff like that. All those dystopian ones like Westworld and all that jazz. Seeing like it could be if it's the right person. Like, I get like the BBC could do it too, imagine.
It's fundamentally British. I wouldn't want an American remake.
No HBO.
Well, unless it's HBO.
Pick a disc.
When watching Bryce, how hard was it to not think of, oh, if I was behind the same desk, I'd be...
Oh, gigs are ruined for me forever. Yeah, it's... You know, there'll be something that, you know, like a reverb will happen, and I'll go, oh, that was nice. And then all my mates are like, Ben, stop it. Just enjoy the gig. The first thing I'll do is I'll always just poke my head over and just go, oh, you're using a Midas Pro 2. Interesting. Okay, cool. Oh, yeah, Digico SD7. Oh, nice. And then the first thing I do and take a picture of it, and they're like, Ben, you're such a nerd. And yes, I know. But I love it. And that's kind of part of the enjoyment these days.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.